Welcome. Today, we're going to talk about an interesting subject. It's actually a topic that I presented in the middle of COVID with Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and Rabbi Seth Farber, in which we discuss, in quotation marks, the excommunication, and it's really, really about how Orthodox Judaism in the United States has felt a struggle around policing its community, how it understands the contours and how it decides who's in and who's out. So if you're looking for somebody to report something or speak with certain absolutes, that's not the case. In the 1980s, Rabbi Greenberg was involved in a rather sordid and cantankerous affair with the Rabbinical Council of America. I've written about it with Seth Farber, my friend. But to get there, we're going to look at this long durée, this history of what I call religious policing. And I don't mean that, and I know I'm offering a little bit of a preamble here. I don't mean to say that's a good thing or a bad thing. All communities need to understand how to move people and ideas inside and outside. And it's not me, for this purpose, I'm a historian. It's not for me to decide who's in and who's out. What's interesting is how does Orthodox Judaism do that? And it did, right? Cherem, the idea of excommunication, it's built into Masechet Sanhedrin. It has several chapters in Maimonides' Mishnah Torah. How that works in a modern America is a very fraught thing. And so that's what we're going to talk about for a little bit this morning. So let me share my screen. Give me 1 second. Okay. First, the 19th century. In 1856 and 1857, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, who becomes the architect of Reform Judaism in the United States, he edits a siddur, a prayer book, called Minhag America. It's interesting because it's in English. There had been a few, not many, Reform prayer books and published in the United States before then, but they were all in German because most Jews, their first language was German. Here was Isaac Meir Wise understanding that America needed something different. Needed something different, and they needed to embrace a certain idea of Americanization, and English language was going to be critical for that. Sorry for the glitch. Let me just reshare. There we go. Okay. So here's Isaac Meir Wise in the center. And he publishes this book called Minhag America, The Daily Prayers. And shortly after it's published, he's in Cincinnati, which was the sort of the frontier of America, California, clearly by 1849. But Cincinnati was very much that segue, that way station along the western frontier. And for the Jewish community in the United States, it certainly was the frontier by then. In Shachnei Isaacs, not a well-known figure whatsoever in American Jewish history. He's a Jew, an Orthodox Jew in Cincinnati, and he burns Minhag America in effigy. And by 1865, not in Cincinnati, but in New York, this another not well-known figure, Eliyahu Holtzman, publishes a book called Emek Rephaim, The Valley of Ghosts. And here it is, the title page on the left, Kolel Ed Ma'at, Hakamod ve'echod ha'medina medina d'America Lo, makvir yomam amduket nikraim b'shem rofaim. He plays on rifaim, ghosts, but also doctors. The idea that there are these doctors. He says that there are these rofaim, these doctors, these reformers. So it's a sort of a play on words here in Hebrew. And he writes in parentheses, doctor or doctors. Vehima portse peretz lahavir takanot Ezra sofer. And they deign to, destroy, to break the rabbinic ordinances of Ezra pertaining to prayer. Luvatel kol tefilot va'piyutim. And to get rid of so many of the essential, what he viewed as the essential components of prayer. And so toward the end, not on this page, but this is actually from my reader, Modern Orthodox Judaism, where I translated initially, anyone who calls himself a member of Israel, when he sees this wayward book, referring to Minhag America, that has engraved on it the prayers of B'nai Yeshurun. B'nai Yeshurun was the name of the congregation in Cincinnati that Isaac Meir Weiss led. And Minhag America must immediately burn it, like Shachne Isaacs. He actually devoted this book, this little tract, to Shachne Isaacs. No one in the United States of America is capable of amending the prayers or piyutim that were established by the ancients. Anyone who dares to embark on this is labeled a heretic. Now, of course, what is the impact? Minhag America became a bestseller. It went through several printings, and for Wise became the touchstone for him to become not the uncontested. Certainly there were more radical reformers than he who would have laid claim to it, but he became one of the most pivotal figures in Reform Judaism in the second half of the 19th century. Burning his book was a statement, but it did not excommunicate Wise in any way. For some of you, this is probably more familiar. Mordechai Kaplan in A Prehistory of Orthodox Heresy Hunting is an important issue. See that there are elements in the chat. We'll take some of the chats. I'll check the chat. Please, if you have any questions, but we'll get to most of them. I assume we'll have a lively conversation toward the end. Somebody in the chat does point out that, of course, Rambam, Maimonides, his own books were burned. Rabbeinu Yonah apologized, though. In a recent issue, the American Hebrew, this is on the left side. So this is an editorial in the early 20th century. In a recent issue of the American Hebrew, we called attention to the resolution passed by a number of Orthodox rabbis. This is referring to the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, not the Agudas Yisrael, but the Agudas HaRabbanim. A big difference between the two. One, not only did one start much earlier than the other in the United States, but the Agudas HaRabbanim, they were Zionists. The Agudas Yisrael was not. Condemning any of their colleagues preaching in English or countenancing the teaching of Jewish religion. Let me move the Zoom screen away. So Zoom control so I can read it. Jewish religion, any other language but Yiddish. It is evident that these rabbis did not consider this sufficient, for they have now gone a step farther and have issued a circular, sort of a papal bill, in which they say that the graduates of the Jewish Theological Seminary, who call themselves rabbis, have no right to act as rabbis and teachers according to the law and scriptures and the Talmud, and warning any Orthodox congregation against appointing seminary graduates as their spiritual guides. One of the most prominent Orthodox congregations in the city recently appointed a former seminary student to its religious head, as its religious head, and all the fury of these Orthodox rabbis has been directed against the synagogue and its leaders. So what are they referring to? They're referring to in 1904, the Agudas HaRabbanim sets out a papal bull, essentially excoriating not just the use of English before all sermons were delivered in Yiddish, of course. The irony is that a sermon was something incorporated into synagogues that was borrowed from Protestant Germany. It's not really part of the rhythm of the service that is do right there do button. But nevertheless, the idea of introducing English was seen as certainly socially and culturally anathema to a certain segment of the Orthodox community, certainly. And the seminary, which was then the only traditional rabbinical school in the United States, Hebrew Union College, was formed in the 1870s. The seminary comes about in 1886. And what now is Yeshiva University by the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary doesn't really get started until the late 1890s. Before then, 1887 was the founding of the Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, a preparatory school. But what we now know as YU was reorganized several times over. And it's not really until the emergence of Bernard Revel in 1915 that we have a more solid yeshiva. By then, and so until then, the seminary, JTS that is, that didn't call itself conservative, that term would come much, much later. My friend Mike Cohn has written a very important book on this subject. In 1902 was reorganized under Solomon Schachter, who didn't like certain sectarian or denominational monikers, but he stated several times over, push came to shove, he would call himself Orthodox. Now, again, what's interesting is I'm not interested here in what are the components of Orthodoxy. I'm not interested here in if somebody keeps this part of Shulchan Aruch versus another. That's not our business here. I'm interested in the self-identification and how communities are formed, constructed, and deconstructed. So for Schachter to call himself Orthodox and for the seminary to be the only rabbinical institution that supported the traditional rabbinate to introduce English language sermons was an affront to the Agudas HaRabbanim, which were entirely members who were born and trained in Europe at the time. Didn't even speak English, let alone deliver sermons in Yiddish. And then comes Mordechai Kaplan, born in Europe. That is the case, was somebody who didn't quite train at the seminary under Schachter. He eventually becomes sort of this student of Schachter, or at least purports to be so, went back to Europe under his father's request to receive rabbinic ordination from rabbinic leaders in Europe as well. But here's a speech he delivers at the Jewish Center. We have a number of Jewish Center folks in this class right now, so it's particularly resonant to talk about it. Kaplan lived for a very long time, and although he did not coin the term Jewish Center, certainly made it an institution. Not only that, the Young Israel movement, other aspects, there's so much within Orthodoxy that Mordechai Kaplan gave life to, and certainly he abandoned Orthodoxy when he abandoned the Jewish Center in the early 1920s. This is a speech he delivers. Actually, if you see over here, it's quite small. I apologize, but it is a defense in 1921 of people who were accusing him of being outside of Orthodoxy. So he wasn't yet out. He pushes himself out. As I say, I want to disabuse your minds of the impression that I have come with a new revelation and that I am advocating anything that is contrary to historical or traditional Judaism. I want to make clear to you, again, this is in 1921, that historical traditional Judaism in its continuity is what I stand for and what I work for. If in the interpretation of it, I have said something that was different from what the hearer expected, the fact of the matter is that the hearer drew the conclusion that I am not advocating traditional or historical Judaism. It's not my fault. It's the listener who is interpreting me as being outside of Orthodox Judaism. We have become so used to a certain type of preaching, to a certain set of ideas or arguments advanced to prove the correctness of a traditional or historical Judaism, that if we hear another kind of argument, another kind of defense, we draw the conclusion that the man who is advancing this other kind of argument or defense is not advocating historical Judaism, but some new kind of Judaism. It's fascinating. So Kaplan, when this becomes a moot point because within a couple of months, he himself has resigned from the Jewish Center and he has started the left wing branch, the left flank of conservative Judaism, Reconstructionist Judaism. So it becomes a moot point. But at this point, what is Kaplan suggesting? He's saying, look, there are people who say that I'm not Orthodox. I'm not a traditional Jew. Why are they doing that? Is because I'm invoking Freud. I am speaking about current events. I'm using I'm a sociologist. I'm an education researcher, says Kaplan. I'm using the language of the academy, of American culture. It's the hearer that is getting bent out of shape because they're not listening correctly. And they're paying too much attention to the trimming, and not enough to the core of the substance of what I'm articulating. Now, it turns out that those critics were correct. Kaplan embedded their suspicions about Kaplan. Kaplan added himself. He didn't want to stay in the Orthodox fold any longer. But what's very, very interesting is that so much about what the detection about and the criticism of Kaplan, who denied our traditional view of God, certainly, who changed, who edited a new Siddur, a new prayer book, and deleted certain core tenets of Orthodox Judaism, who edited the Haggadah, who did not believe in a chosenness any longer. Those are very clear. It became untenable for Kaplan to consider himself part of the Orthodox rabbinate or their community, and became a moot point, as I said. But you see in these previous matters that the suspicions about heresy were not about core ideas within Orthodox Judaism, but instead were in, and they're no small things, in the vehicles in which they're communicated, whether it be English as opposed to Yiddish language sermons, or just the style in which the Orthodox rabbinate was communicating to the people in the pews. And that's what's really interesting. So much about the policing, and I take it very, very seriously. The heresy hunting within Orthodox Judaism doesn't only monitor the 13 principles of faith. Right. Professor Mark Shapiro has written an important book, as has Menachem Kellner, to our duet from a theology of orthodoxy's point of view, is what theologies are in and out. That's not our business here. What's interesting here is the detection based on external factors, based on the production of orthodoxy rather than the core principles of it. So let's fast forward to the 1980s. This is from the Medrash Says. The Medrash Says, which is ostensibly a compendium of summaries of Midrash, of rabbinic teachings and stories pertaining to the weekly Torah portion of the Parshat HaShavua. But every so often, the editors of the Medrash Says offer a footnote or some contemporary critique. So here, the editors write, in asterisk and a note, this mitzvah includes the acquisition of tefillin, mezuzahs, and other religious articles that were written with the greatest meticulousness and halachic perfection. The Midrash indicates that a Jew should direct the innate aesthetic appreciation common to all mankind towards the acquisition of beautiful objects of Kedusha rather than exert efforts toward the acquisition of objects of ephemeral value such as elegant furniture and clothing. Okay, so spend your money on clay mitzvah, on instruments that we use to better our religious lives than to purchase expensive couches. Okay, I think people can get on board with that sentiment. The Torah concept of striving for beauty and perfection in the fulfillment of mitzvos, requires self-education. It stands in stark contrast to the sad reality of a $20,000 bar mitzvah. Now, again, it's 1980s, halavai, $20,000, smorgasbord, orchestra and all, for which the cheapest pair of tefillin were purchased. So they are bemoaning the fact that they attend bar mitzvahs in which there are orchestras, and yet the bar mitzvah boy has a very low level parrots fill in given to him. Likewise, people spend great sums of furnishing a home with only first quality articles and the very best interior, yet the same home is provided the cheapest of mezuzahs. So there is this admonishment in the 1980s when there was considerable wealth growing in the American economy, but also in the also great inflation, but in the Orthodox and Jewish communities, about admonishing people that if you're going to buy big homes, if you're going to spend lots of money, make sure that your performance of mitzvot and your religious possessions also elevate along with your other budgets for non-religious activities and objects. Fine. Take a look in the pages of the Jewish Observer, also in our pivotal 1980s. I also object to the implication that Beis Yaakov is gearing girls for a college education. To the contrary. So what else is on the table to not just say out of bounds is education for the first time. Before then, at least in the breach, Orthodox young men and women were attending college, with the exception of Lakewood Tells and Cleveland permitted their boys to attend college after they left Tells. But certainly in Brooklyn, whether it be Chaim Berlin or Tor Vadas, there were partnerships, essentially, with Brooklyn College to attend night school. By the 1980s, that had changed starkly. To the contrary, college is discouraged both openly and implicitly. I should also say in Beis Yaakov schools as well. While there was a cool, not an embrace, but a cool understanding of need for college education, by the 1980s, more and more Beis Yaakov schools were discouraging, if not prohibiting, their young women from matriculating to college. No heterim, dispensations are given. Well, if you're going to support your husband, you can go to college. Even office work is discouraged. Girls are basically geared towards becoming teachers to transmit what they were taught and to keep advancing in their spiritual life even after they leave school. In Lakewood, the majority of women help their husbands continue learning through A, part-time jobs, teaching mainly secretarial, etc. B, selling things at home. C, services at home, babysitting, typing, income tax help, etc. And D, economizing. A very, very small percentage, writes this letter writer in the pages of Jewish Observer, a very, very small percentage is of the college-educated, career-pursuing variety. Check it out. And so college was now under siege, and for certain portions, the rightward portion of the Orthodox community, seemed out of bounds if you want to stay within the Orthodox community. Let me just share. I point out in the, it's a little bit small, but Rav Aaron Cutler, the founder of Beis Medrash Gaon Lakewood, was always opposed to college. But he was the outlier, really, until the 1980s. Let me stop here before I return to the modern Orthodox community. I saw that there were a lot of comments in the chat. Okay. Any questions? A lot of comments. So a lot of comments about Yiddish versus English. It's also it's important to understand the moment in time and the fear involved.
May I suggest that you take questions later at the end?
Happy to. I just wanted to see if there were any
Thank
big
you.
Problems. Sure. Okay. Good advice. So, Rabbi Norman Lamb, who is the, by then, the rather young president of the Yeshiva University, he takes over in the mid-70s, this is in 1979, in the pages of the Jewish Week, an article titled, Lamb Warns Intolerance, Error Based on Torah is Not Heresy. So, what is he, this article reporting on a speech he gave in the bold at the very top paragraph, the end of the very top paragraph, the pressure for a monolithic Orthodox community is greater than ever, and it is not healthy. Rabbi Lamb said he hesitated to engage in a recitation of the instances of bigotry and shallow-mindedness that afflict us, little self-contained clumps of self-righteous super-piety come into being, each specializing in condemning and attacking some phantasmagoric heretic. Those who celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, the Israel Independence Day, those who do not eat glot meat, and certainly those who take anything but a grudging attitude to higher secular education. He refused to accept that such totalitarian, authoritarian narrowness is the way of the Torah whose ways are the ways of pleasantness. I refuse to accept the proposition that can flourish only in closed minds, and that Judaism, to be authentic, must be intolerant. I do not believe any of us is ready to make such concessions. More devoutness, certainly. More bigotry, certainly not. Aggressiveness, yes. Offensiveness, no. What Rabbi Lamb is concerned about is the shifting that he's noticing already at Yeshiva University and in other places, and about more and more talk about banning stuff and banning people in the 1980s in Orthodox Judaism. Now, Peter Berger, the social scientist, actually I have a book right over here, called The Heretical Imperative, that comes out in the late 1970s. And he assumes, does the great sociologist Berger, that really no tradition-bound faith in the United States has a chance in what he calls this techno-modern society, with radical changes in communication. Back then he meant the fax machine. And the porousness of American society, no community that looks at itself as somehow unchanging or capable of maintaining its a certain close-knittedness, not close-mindedness, but close-knittedness within the United States, really understands how religion in America can operate. And so one example he gives, I think it's on page 28, I've cited it so many times, is the example of Orthodox Judaism, where traditionalism is a core value to that community, and how can it possibly withstand the tug and pull of so-called heresies? You can't insulate your community in modern America. I think towards the end of his life, he realized that there were instruments. There were levers that leaders within the Orthodox community in particular can pull, admits Berger much later on, I think in 2014, 2015, that he did not consider in The Heretical Imperative, again, written on the eve of the 1980s. And so the Jewish newspapers, they really don't make them like they used to. Gary Rosenblatt, then the editor of the Baltimore Jewish Times, writes about religious McCarthyism. Now, this is in the mid-80s. This is still during the Cold War. So that had severe implications. He's writing in Baltimore about the planned arrival and talk of Rabbi. He just changed how he would refer to himself. He's no longer Rabbi Stephen Riskin. He was now Rabbi Shlomo Riskin. That in Baltimore, some elements had anticipated his arrival by posting posters essentially around town, warning people to be careful about this Rabbi Riskin, this chief rabbi of Efrat. After all, haven't you heard that none other than Rav Shach, the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, has excoriated him and excommunicated him? We don't need his type here in Baltimore. Jonathan Mark, so in the paper that Gary Rosenblatt would eventually take the helm, modern Orthodox rabbis claim assault from the RCA right wing, and who are in the crosshairs? If you just take a look at the over here, it's Rabbi Irving, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, Rabbi Avi Weiss, and Rabbi Mark Angel, who are supposedly under fire within the Rabbinical Council of America in the mid-1980s. So what's happening? So again, a little small, but bear with me. In 1987, Rabbi Pinchas Stolper, who emerges as not the founding director, there were a couple of false starts, but definitely the longest and formative leader of NCSY, who eventually becomes the executive director of the Orthodox Union, dashes off a letter in 1987 to Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, who was then in Chicago. He would come back to Yeshiva University in a few years from then, but still live in Chicago. Dear Rabbi Soloveitchik, enclose the copy of Perspectives, This is a journal that was edited by CLA, the organization led by Rabbi Yitz Greenberg. A long article by Rabbi Irving, by Irving and Yitz Greenberg of CLA, setting forth his views. I have read a good part of it, and I realize that it contains shocking and dangerous views. Unfortunately, a number of our own Orthodox Jews are being taken in by his rhetoric and are unaware of the dangers his attitudes represent. It appears to me that you would be the ideal individual, especially since you are probably going to discuss this topic at the forthcoming RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, convention, to pen an appropriate reply, which would be suitable for publication in Jewish Action, the monthly magazine of the Orthodox Union. I would be most grateful were you to be able to find the time to do this. With warmest personal regards and deepest respect, I am still yours, Rabbi Pinchas Stolper. What he sends a copy of is Rabbi Greenberg's view of broken covenant. Rabbi Greenberg, a little bit about Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, a very important theologian, certainly in Holocaust theologian in particular. Rabbi Greenberg actually encountered Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik during a cause celeb in the 1960s, in which he sat for an interview with the editors of the YU undergraduate newspaper called The Commentator. And he said some things which were maybe the language, the tone he'd admit were not on point for that community at that time. Not issues actually about Vietnam. Those were taken in kind. And most famously, then another faculty member at the time, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, published a very, very important open letter called Dear Yitzchak to Rabbi Greenberg. But one of the, at Yeshiva, one of the most vocal opponents of Rabbi Greenberg was then a young faculty member named Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. In the speech that he delivers, and it's, you can find it online, he doesn't even refer to Rabbi Greenberg, he calls him Professor X. I don't know if he was an X-Men fan, but he called him Professor X throughout. And so Rabbi Greenberg eventually leaves Yeshiva. He teaches at CUNY. He's in Riverdale. He's a very, very important figure. He's at the Riverdale Jewish Center. He also founds CLAL, which is an organization committed to pluralism. Rabbi Greenberg is an important person in that pluralistic world, not just with CLAL, but certainly with the Wexner Foundation, with AIPAC, with Federation. And he delivers some of the most important lectures and offers almost a theology for a lot of these organizations, which are very important to this day. So that's Rabbi Greenberg. And Rabbi Stolper is suggesting to Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik in the late 1980s, can you please do something? We need a leader. After all, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik's older brother, the Rev, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, is not well at this time. He has retired from public leadership, certainly by 1987, really by the end of 1985. And that's who is claiming the mantle of leadership in the modern Orthodox community. There are other there are other points that I'm sharing here. Is actually it's you take a look at on the right side. Here is Rabbi Greenberg and his theology for a little bit. He actually alludes to this whole episode in his in this memoir that was published in the early 1980s. So Rabbi Greenberg is no stranger to controversy within the Orthodox community. But what's really, really important to point out is that in other instances with the seminary, eventually the seminary leaders do not want to be within the Orthodox fold. Again, my issue isn't, is somebody Orthodox anymore? With the issue of Mordechai Kaplan, very quickly after there were antagonists who emerged, he no longer wanted to stay within the Orthodox fold. Rabbi Greenberg was clear. I'm an Orthodox leader and I'm an Orthodox rabbi. And he felt he needed to fight these critics. And we'll get into it. Among his critics, Rabbi Herschel Schachter writes in opposition to CLA, but not on the broken covenant ideas. So there was actually two theologies that Rabbi Greenberg made clear. And actually, he just published a new book, and he sort of softens the first one. Broken Covenant suggests that maybe oversimplifying, not oversimplifying, but it takes much, much longer to develop this. But essentially, with the Holocaust, offers Rabbi Greenberg. And again, he's toned it down in the last year or two in his new book, memoir.
In the middle, yeah. Anything urgent?
I'm sorry, can everybody mute, please?
Let me just... if you can, no, not really. Okay, thank you.
Let me mute everybody. All right, sorry about that. Muted everybody. Broken Covenant was the issue that Rabbi Stolper anticipated would become a major point of divergence between Greenberg and the Orthodox community. It wasn't so. What is Broken Covenant? Broken Covenant assumes that after the Holocaust, the fact that God could, again, this is not my view, after God had allowed the Holocaust to happen, that the covenant between the Jewish people and God had been broken, and it was now incumbent upon Jews to be the active participant in the relationship between the Jewish people and God, and they had to do it on their terms, which is a very, very important theology for pluralism. Some Jews come back to God on halachic terms, others through support of Zionism, other more meaningful things, but the way in which Jews, the Jewish people, and God connected was no longer specifically through observance of Jewish law. It was a multiplicity of things. That was Broken Covenant in 20 seconds or less. What becomes the major point of divergence isn't Broken Covenant. And I'm not exactly sure why. The other one was his idea of a failed Messiah. That's the theology that here in a Yiddish publication, Rabbi Moshe Scherer picks up. You can see my cursor on the right. And Rabbi Herschel Schachter picks up in a published article, again, that pivotal 19, both in the, published in the 1980s. So before we get to some documents that I found in Rabbi Greenberg's papers held at Harvard Widener Library's Judaica division, failed Messiah is a really interesting turn of phrase. What was the term used before then? False Messiah. Bar Kokhba was a false Messiah. Jesus was a false Messiah. Offers Greenberg. I don't know. Shabtai Tzvi, false Messiah? But did he, maybe he had the capacity to be a Messiah. It's that he failed at becoming a Messiah. And that offered a level of credence to the non-Orthodox, and even certainly the non-Jewish community, that the Orthodox community was deeply uncomfortable with. And so a number of people within the Vada Kavod, which is sort of the ethics community of the Rabbinical Council of America, decide that they need to review Rabbi Greenberg's vita and decide whether or not he would be allowed within the ranks of the Rabbinical Council of America. Here is a letter, a memo, during this whole episode, this whole encounter in the late 1980s from Yitz Greenberg to then president of the RCA, Milton Pollan. He writes to Rabbi Pollan, "I am an Orthodox rabbi, not only because of my beliefs in Torah Min HaShemayim, Torah from heaven, and in Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition from Sinai, and my commitment to the totality of the tradition, but also by the record of my actual professional service. Everywhere I have served, I have strengthened orthodoxy. Look at my record. People are firmer because of me, and left behind an important legacy of orthodox institutional strength and participation in the community." So when he was a doctoral student at Harvard, he writes about his involvement at Brandeis, my work at Yeshiva University in the 60s, where I exerted a strong, continuing positive religious influence. Number three, I founded Yavna, right, that collegiate organization, that was very important for folks in sect, for young women and men at places like Columbia and others. I founded Yavna, which served as a major chizuk, strengthening for Orthodox youth in college. My work at the Riverdale Jewish Center. So he really reviews, and you can see the passion in his defense of his Orthodox bona fides. The founding of Klal, he offers in number 5, continues with Klal A, B, and C. And then after he enumerates all of these items on this middle page, even the assault on my writings distorts the perspective. My most extensive writing for Klal, now brought together in my first full-length book, scheduled publication within the year, it would take a little bit longer than that, is a guide to the Yom, oh, not this one. This one actually should come out very soon, to Yom Tovim, to the holidays, and Shabbat, which explicates the message of complete observance and the values of the halachic system. The latest assault on me uses the claim of my theological writings on Christianity, the failed Messiah, to undermine my legitimacy. I believe there is nothing in those writings that is not justified by previous sources in the tradition, albeit the dominant tone of tradition has been far more hostile. So it says there's a minority view that coheres with me. Moreover, the article is being used out of context and being read by people who have little or no sophistication theologically or awareness of even the language that is standard in such encounters. The article is written for a highly specialized group and is being circulated to people who will misread it. This is done for political purposes, to combine a charge that I am somehow accepting Christianity and soft on reform and conservative groups in my work to create a shadow of doubt about me is utterly misleading and without merit. I need not add that if this whole issue were to be uncovered by the press, it would cause a national Chilul Hashem. It would be alleged that someone is being disqualified as an Orthodox rabbi. Again, the levers of orthodoxy and the issue of heresy hunting, of excommunication, was unseemly, and it probably is to a certain American mores, for daring to write respectfully of Christians, even though it is no way compromised Jewish integrity. Many leading Jewish and Christian theologians would testify that they understand quite clearly that I have yielded none of the distinctive Jewish faith claims, nor have I in any way broken down the lines of true normative distinction between Judaism and Christianity. Thus, it will appear that the assault is both bigoted and based on misreading. This will only add to the Chilul Hashem. I ask you not only to use your leadership to stop the present unjustified assault, but to create a new situation in which I can take a rightful role as a discussant. Let me have a conversation. Role as a discussant, and even protagonist for important discussions within Orthodoxy. The issues I am wrestling with are difficult, and they are on the frontiers of the community. But if we cannot protect the right to explore those issues, the community will be weakened at its heart and not just on its frontiers. He's hearing about it, and finally he gets the letter from the Vada Kavod, from Rabbi Bernard Rosenzweig, the chairman of the Ethics Committee, Vada Kavod of the Rabbinical Council of America. The executive committee has mandated that the Vada Kavod ask you, this is over here, to appear before the VOD. So he got what he wanted for. He got an audience in order to discuss certain actions which you have recently taken, which may be in violation of RCA regulations and procedures. This continues on for the balance of the 1980s. Here you see a letter from the new chairman of the Vada Kavod, Rabbi Zeb Siegel. Dear Rabbi Greenberg, the executive of the Rabbinical Council of America has mandated the Vada Kavod to investigate those colleagues who have national hashkachas, and to determine whether they are in violation of the 1954 accord with the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, that no RCA men would compete with the OU. Your name has been submitted to us as one of those who may be in this category. Rabbi Greenberg did not have any hashgacha, any kosher supervision accounts. After reviewing this matter, it was decided by the Bada Kavva to invite you to appear in order to discuss this matter personally. Dear Rabbi Siegel, I have today received your letter of January 11th. So he's responding directly to this letter, informing me that my name was submitted to the VOD as one of those colleagues who may be in the category of those colleagues who have hashgachas, and to determine whether they are in violation of the 1954 accord with the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America. In your letter, you invite me to discuss this matter with the Bada Kavva personally on February 22nd. I have no hashgachas, national or local. Right? That's not my source of income. And never have had any. He talks about his time koshering the kitchen at Brandeis. And he puts, skipping out of the parentheses, since I have no hashgachas, I am sure you will agree that it is pointless to have a meeting with the Vada covered on this matter. If there is anything else on your mind, please let me know, as I mean no disrespect to the Vada covered. I would appreciate being informed in writing so that I can understand properly and appear properly and keep an appropriate record of this matter. Thank you for consideration. Yours, Irving Greenberg. Next communication about 6 months later. Dear Yitz, this is from Rabbi Benjamin Wallfish, Executive Vice President, the leading staff member of the RCA. I have been asked by the Bada Kavva to inform you that at the executive committee meeting on August 23rd, 1989, so it's going to be in the future, the following resolution will be presented to the executive committee. Make sure we have enough time for discussion. Whereas Rabbi Irving Greenberg, as founder and president of Klal, so it was never about Hashkachas, sponsored religious services which do not meet even minimal requirements of halacha. So at these conferences at Klal, there were services for different branches of American Judaism. The RCA regrets that it must censor this conduct and calls upon Rabbi Greenberg to discontinue such practices. So it's already softening the language already about whether you're in or out of the RCA. This resolution takes into consideration Rabbi Greenberg's committing himself orally and in writing that he will no longer be involved in such practices. It is the policy of the Bada Kavva to inform the member of what action is going to be taken so that he can be present at the meeting if he so desires and make any efforts in the interim to address himself to this matter. With kind regards, best wishes, I am sincerely Rabbi Benjamin Wallfish. So we're now changing, but still very interested in making sure who is in and out of the Orthodox rabbinate, which ideas are a part of it. We're looking now at different aspects of Rabbi Greenberg's career, trying to really refine its argument. Writes Greenberg then to an important lay leader, in the last 24 hours, the RCA leadership has given us assurances that the matter will not be brought up in any way at the August 23rd meeting. Based on that representation, our need to seek judicial relief at this time has become academic, and we therefore do not plan to file a lawsuit now. So Rabbi Greenberg was really, lawyering up. We will now explore possibilities of a positive outcome. We hope that there will be goodwill and sensitivity to diffuse the controversy and to find a solution that will be in everyone's interest. Writes the same lay leader, Ludwig Jesselson, to the leadership of the RCA, including carbon copy, a copy to Rabbi Norman Lamb, defending Rabbi Greenberg. And that's also important that you see advanced lay leadership in the Orthodox community as well. Writes back Rabbi Shire about this issue. Back to Ludwig Jesselson. Dear Mr. Jesselson, I have just returned from a 5-week stay in Israel. I'm in receipt of your letter. He writes in the second paragraph. It is completely unprecedented in the annals of the Rabbinical Council for anyone outside of the members of the Vada Kavva to involve himself. So since when does a layperson get to decide matters of a rabbinical organization, writes Rabbi Shire, the then president of the RCA. I note that you've sent a copy of our correspondence to Dr. Lamb, still president of Yeshiva University. Dr. Lamb is not only a highly respected Rosh Hashiva and president of Yeshiva University, but he is a dear friend and classmate. We have known each other close to 50 years, and we share many views. I am working with him to solve the most acute problems in the Jewish world, and we share a commitment to the total Jewish community. I hope that the matter of Rabbi Greenberg, about which you get so excited, will be settled in a satisfactory manner. Certainly, I will make every effort to do that. I pray that my colleagues will be similarly minded. And here's our last slide. What is the, what I call the settlement of it? Writes Rabbi Greenberg that he will make sure that he davens. I believe that it is recognized that I have not davened and do not daven at non-Orthodox services. I want to make sure that as an Orthodox rabbi at a pluralist organization, you understand that I myself create these boundaries. And that was an agreement that he would say, that if there was any doubt of that, that he's going to make it clear in writing. And then this is, but then that's in the left responding to the letter on the right. So what do we make of it? The goalposts are always changing. It's a culture that I've argued usually excommunication and boundary policing came from what we would call the right flank of the Orthodox Jewish community. But even in the 1980s, the modern Orthodox community needed to police its own boundaries. Part of that was the emergence, the real rise of the so-called yeshiva world. If you take a look at the Pew study, both 2013 and 2020, you'll see that those who self-report as modern Orthodox represent 30% of the total Orthodox community. To put that in perspective, in nowadays demography, there are 5 million Jews in the United States. Brandeis counts as upward towards 7 million. Let's use 5 million, easy numbers. If Orthodox Judaism represents 10% of that population, there are 500,000 Orthodox Jews in the United States. I'd argue that they don't properly account for the huge numbers in Lakewood or in Muncie or in Satmar, but let's just assume that there are 500,000 Orthodox Jews in the United States. If in fact modern Orthodoxy is 30% of that 10%, then there are a total of 150,000 self-identifying modern Orthodox Jews living in the United States. 150,000. To put that in fuller relief, the total Jewish population of Lakewood and its surrounding environs, which I think we'll all agree, most likely the total population of Jewish community in Lakewood and its surrounding neighborhoods. And we can assume that most, Rubo Kikulo, the vast majority of Jews living in Lakewood are Orthodox Jews. That we would call it as part of the yeshiva. So that is to say, again, if you take Pew at face value, there are 150,000 modern Orthodox Jews. The Jewish population of greater Lakewood is 150,000. The yeshiva world in Lakewood tomorrow is larger than the current modern Orthodox community in the United States. I'm just reporting numbers. It wasn't like that, but that sea change begins in the 1980s. And modern Orthodoxy needs to react and police its borders because it cannot afford to hemorrhage. And not only that, Rabbi Soloveitchik had retired in 1985. The conservative movement had started to ordain women as rabbis in the mid-80s, and Rabbi Greenberg's wife, Lou Greenberg, had published a number of essays championing ordination of women in Orthodoxy at that time. You had Rabbi Avi Weiss not using, certainly he would be eventually found Chovei Torah, but had started to talk about a rabbinical school in partnership with sort of a breakaway from the conservative movement called the UTJ, the Union of Traditional Judaism. I see some people nodding. They remember it this time. I'm sort of giving you your own memoir. But there was a lot of shuffling in the modern Orthodox world at that time. Patrilineal dissent and some talks among the conservative movement, and Gerson Cohn, the chancellor of JTS, to consider patrilineal descent for conservative Judaism, meant that modern orthodoxy needed to guard its left flank. And rightly or wrongly, and it's not me, certainly not Torah in Motion, or anybody's view to decide who in is in and who is out. But looking at diagnosing the historical infrastructure in the context of the 1980s, modern orthodoxy had a challenge. On the one hand, they sensed that the yeshiva world and so-called right wing of orthodoxy was rising. On the other hand, it needed to separate itself from any conception that it was somehow moving into what they would have called the abyss of non-Orthodox Judaism. Rabbi Greenberg represented part of that left flank, whether through his broken covenant, through failed Messiah, or simply just leading a pluralistic organization which countenanced prayer in something other than an Orthodox fashion. And so all of these different variables were crushing the decision-making of the RCA, the OU, YU, the larger Orthodox community. There's a famous article also by Jonathan Mark called Lamb Under Siege, which represented that again in those as we move into the 1990s. And it really set in motion a lot of really challenging decision-making for that modern Orthodox community. I'm sure there's resonance into our own time, but that's for sociologists or political scientists, not for a historian like me. So I'll take some questions. I'll take a look. If there's any. Okay. So some people have some important things. Yes, Rabbi Stolper was very important with Kiruv. Others, yeah, I'll make sure we'll send the slides so people can look at them. I understand that they don't project there when I put them on to PowerPoint. They don't get quite big enough, so I'll make sure they're bigger in the next go around. Absolutely. Okay, no rebuttals. Oh, Shelley, one, and then we'll take one or two questions. Shelley, go ahead.
I'd like to know the methodology behind the Pew reports, because the numbers just don't seem right.
It's a good,
and that makes a big difference. I mean, looking around, and most Jews don't identify with any movement at all whatsoever. They consider themselves either cultural, secular, whatever, and I don't even know where they're getting the numbers of intermarriage. But if it really is what it seems to be, we're hemorrhaging people right and left, and it seems that the what used to be called modern Orthodox, the idea that you could have secular education and secular culture and still be totally from, is dead. It's the super right wing has won.
You know, the Pew report on American Jews is available for you to look, and you can look at their how they logically put it out there, how they weighted certain variables. I agree that it's likely. I think that it's hard to do that just because of sheer concentration of Orthodox Jews. Can the Eruv, for example, it's a major town. So Rosemary, go ahead. You'll, Rosemary and Asher, and then we'll say goodbye. Go ahead.
What was the reaction of the mainstream Orthodox to the Chavurah movement that developed?
The Chavurah movement was less of a challenge because it was decidedly undenominational. Meaning, it's true that that many of its leaders came out of the conservative movement, but these were independent minyanim. I know now that term means something else, that materialized. And so in its time, there wasn't any great outcry against it. Also in college towns. So Orthodox Judaism was heavily centralized leadership in New York at the time. And so I'm not aware, and I've looked far and wide, that there was any deep reaction to the Chavurah movement in the 1970s. That's a good question. Asher, go ahead.
How do you think the story you told today lines up with the case of Rav Nosson Kamenetsky and his publishing of the book, The Making of a Gadol?
No, it's interesting. In both cases, what we see is people who want, feel deservingly that they are part of the Orthodox community. And I'm very clear is that the other instances that we looked at, as we ramped up toward the 1980s, those were interesting examples, but they weren't for people who eventually would consider themselves Orthodox. The case of, so Making of a Gadol was an important memoir, very big, very long, very large book. It's not clear why it was excommunicated. Was it because it reported that certain major Rosh Yeshiva wrote love letters to their fiancés? All sorts of different reasons why, but the idea of making of a gadol, you're not born a gadol, but you're made, you become one, was, anathema to certain sensibilities within the, yeshiva world. But Rabbi Nassim Kamenetsky defends himself, because he has a stake in it. He himself is a Rosh Yeshiva, a very noted Talmid Chacham, just passed away a couple of years ago. And I think you can draw a number of parallels. I think that there are at first blush. Yeah.
He was my Tzadir Kedushin. I have, I know personally how he reacted to that and stuff like that. But anyway.
All right. So thanks so much. Some number of people have asked just mechanically how we're going to access it. So I'll share the PowerPoints and you have access there, and I'll make sure they're blown up bigger. That's why I did a lot of reading today, make sure that we could look at it. I know that a lot of you, I may just squint more than you would like to. And we'll make sure I'll make sure I perfect that moving forward. Anyway, hope you have a wonderful day, and I'll see you next week.